He was born blind. I can't imagine what that must be like, actually. Can you? So much you must miss out on. So much you can't experience. So much you're dependent on someone else to help you with. I mean, any object, its size, its shape, what it's made of, I can't work it out with a look. I've got to depend on a feel or someone else's description. And even then, how do I know what colour to imagine for red or blue or yellow? And then one day, seemingly out of the blue, a man stops him, spits on the ground, makes mud with the dirt and the saliva, smears it on his eyes, tells him to go and wash, and when he does so, he can see. I mean, imagine the change. From the very first time he walks back through the door at home, you know, sidesteps the trainers his younger brother's left scattered in the hallway, tells his older sister what a pretty dress she's wearing, and as mum goes all emotional, you know, and there's a mix of hugs and I can't believe it, warns her the pot on the stove is boiling over. I mean, life transformed. And everyone wants to know how and who, and all he can tell them is it was the man they call Jesus. And no, he hasn't seen him. And no, he doesn't know what he looks like. And no, he doesn't know where he is. All he might be able to report is that there was some God talk going on when he was healed. Which isn't surprising for both the religious culture he lives in and the miracle he's experienced. He doesn't have much theology about him. He's certainly not about to pin precise labels on Jesus. All he can say is that once I was blind, now I can see. And that surely Jesus has to be something from God. Not everyone's convinced. I mean, they never are they? And it's the religious establishment that seems to have no interest in the evidence and will look for any other explanation. The PR machine's quickly at work. The man was never blind in the first place. That's their opening shot. But Jesus is not from God and he can't be Messiah. That's their underlying theme. And you don't have a place in the community of God's people is their final word as they throw the once blind man out of the synagogue. It's why some people give up on the search for the spiritual. I mean, who am I meant to believe? How do I know who I'm meant to believe? So many voices out there. I Googled spiritual truth this week. Not even Google could add up the answers. About 6,760,000 results, it said. Well, we may not want to be skeptical, but who wants to be naive? See, I read through John's Gospel. I find all this incident about the blind man there in chapter 9. And I want to say, come on, Jesus, what have you got to say to all of this? I mean, if you want me to believe you, how are you going to help me pick my way through the minefield of spiritual claim and counterclaim? And I come to chapter 10, and all Jesus can do is to start telling sheep stories. I don't know about you, but I'm a townie. I've lived in cities all my life. I mean, sheep stories don't do a lot for me. I quite like the one about the shepherd who was spending a sunny afternoon just vaguely trying to check where all the sheep were scattered on the hillside when this rather too clean Land Rover draws up with a man in the city slicker-type suit, and the guy winds down his window and says to him, he says, if I can tell you how many sheep you've got, he said, could I have one of them? And the shepherd sort of shrugs and says, suppose so. And the guy starts firing questions at him left, right and centre. And he's got his laptop out and he's typing in the answers. And after about 15 minutes, he turns to him and he says, 367. Yeah, the shepherd nods. He said, well, great. Can I have one? He said, I'll have that one. And he points to a black and white one. And the shepherd puts it in the back of the Land Rover. And just as he closes the door, he says, by the way, he says, if I can tell you what job you do, he said, can I have it back? Well, the city slicker thinks, I suppose it's got to play fair, so he nods and he says, you're a management consultant, aren't you? How did you know? Well, he says, you roll up here, you waste a quarter of an hour of my time asking me stupid questions, and then you land up telling me something I knew before you started. Now he says, can I have my dog back? Well, listen. When Jesus starts telling sheep stories, his audience knows what's going on better than that. Here's his first story. And really, it's the shepherd or the stranger. Oh, by the way, don't reduce these to little children's stories. Friends, we live in a country where we've still got enough freedoms that we can say all kinds of things about our leaders and our authorities without much fear. But it's not like that all over the world, is it? And there'll be some of you here tonight from countries where you have to tread very carefully before you say anything about your leaders and your authorities. Some from cultures where the authorities are religious and you sometimes have to tread even more carefully in those situations before you do it. If you're going to talk about leaders being strangers to their people and like thieves and robbers, well, you can understand why you might want to use figures of speech, which is what Jesus is doing here. I tell you the truth, he says. This story matters. Actually, so do the sheep. The stories are told for them to help them in their confusion, to save them from getting tricked and messed around. Actually, they're told for us. Because we need to think of ourselves as sheep this evening, and not to imagine that we're the shepherds. But sheep in those days were valuable. The village sheep pen was a bit like the village bank vault. That's why you paid a watchman to guard it. That's why the man who tries to climb over the wall is like the bank robber, a thief. And shepherds? I don't know what you think of shepherds. You know, whether we've got the idea of them idling along, trailing behind the sheep, leaving the dog to do all the work. But shepherds in those days went in front. They led. So shepherds in the Bible were often a way of speaking of the leader, the king, and the shepherd. Now that would be God's king, Messiah, Christ. See, you realize why these stories are dangerous. Because each one of them is assessing leaders and different leadership styles. And the current leaders aren't going to score favorably in the comparison. Jesus' story speaks too into the confusion we highlighted at the beginning that his listeners had experienced. His story faces up to that reality. It tells me that as I try to make sense of the spiritual world, I will find competing voices. Acknowledges that there are spiritual thieves and robbers trying to climb over the wall. Strangers, like the leaders of Jesus' day, who didn't even know the blind man. And the shepherd of the sheep. He'll do nothing underhand. He's transparent. It's all in the open. You see verse 3? The watchman opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. It's like that with God's shepherd. None of this remote, I'll have that one. No, it's come here, black ear. Come on, short tail. Come along, stumpy legs. I mean, we're not all townies, actually. My friend and colleague Jenny Brown, she's a country girl by origin. She was telling us the other day that she has a prize for sheep judging. Probably got the certificate on her wall. And she assured us that sheep do recognize their shepherd. And they know their name, and often it's a name given because of their particular physical features. Yep, the shepherd knows the sheep, and the sheep knows the shepherd. The sheep follow him because they know his voice. It's an extraordinary picture of intimacy, isn't it? In my ignorance, I kind of imagined you'd only keep track of sheep by numbers. No, you do it by name. It's a far cry from the ideas of a religion restricted to rules and regulations and being good. Here's relationship, mutual recognition. Are there dangerous siren voices around? Sure. But the sheep know the shepherd's voice. If you're one of God's people, you will know his voice when he calls you. You may not like what he says, but you'll know his voice. You may want to run away, but you'll know his voice. You may be very excited and full of hope, or deeply reluctant and full of dread, but you'll know his voice. If you want to know God and his leading, you're not looking for a stranger, but for the shepherd who knows you, actually knows you better than you know yourself. So verse 6, Jesus used this figure of speech, but they didn't understand what he was telling them. So if you haven't got it all yet, you're in good company. And he tries again. But notice, he speaks of a figure of speech. It's not really a parable. Those of you who are used to the gospel accounts and know that Jesus' parables are often followed by an explanation which spells out that this means that and this means the other. It's not like that here. Jesus tells different stories, and he's not explaining all the characters of the first one all over again. Let me try again, he says. He tells more stories to keep the contrast between the true shepherd, Jesus, and the false ones. We've had the shepherd and the stranger. Well, next he tries with the shepherd or the thief. I am the gate. I am the door. I am the shepherd. I scratch my head at first and wonder what he's saying. I mean, is he the lump of metal? Is he the plank of wood? Is he the human being? But I need to think how shepherding was in those days. Go out of the village. Go on the hillside, where there's no village, no watchman, and there's just a simple pen up there. And it's the shepherd who'll stretch himself out across the entranceway, sleep there the night, where he can keep the sheep in and the wolves out. I mean, think of an airport and all those checks you've got to go through before you can ever get on the plane. Passport, boarding pass, luggage, belt, shoes, laptop, scans, x-rays, that's him. He's the gate. I'm the gate for the sheep. Which doesn't sound a terribly outrageous claim like that, does it? But look at verse 9. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. See, at a stroke, in one sentence, he pulls the rug from under the feet of the false messiahs who've gone before and all the religious establishments that claim to guard the true way to God. Whoever enters through me will be saved. I'm expecting that when it comes to joining God's people, there's something of the easy come, easy go to it. You know, I can join up when I want, how I please. And Jesus says it's not like that. And we tend to resent, don't we, the idea of anything that feels restrictive, never mind exclusive, and we wonder why we need to have any gatekeepers in life at all. And if you think about it, we're also remarkably quick to complain if we feel we weren't protected properly, whether that was by a government or social services or a school or even church. When I first went up to Sheffield about 15 years ago now, I remember our very first morning there, I went to the newsagent to buy a paper, and when I got it spread across the front page of the national newspaper was a story that had broken about church abuse in Sheffield. I thought, what have I come to? I would discover over the next few years, as I met some of the people who'd been involved in that church, something of the hurt and the betrayal and the damage that was done. There were incompetences in many different directions and just straight wicked abuse. But it is also true there was a group within that little church that had quite deliberately distanced themselves more and more from any accountability. It was quite hard to take when they then turned around and blamed the same authorities for not protecting them properly. The spiritual world, just like the secular world, can be a dangerous place. All, yes, look at verse 8, all who came before me were thieves and robbers. Look at verse 10. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. That was true for the first century false messiahs, several of them before Jesus appeared. And they'd led their little bands of followers almost invariably to a bloody end at the hands of the Roman occupying forces. That's true for the 20th century atheistic regimes, from Stalin through Mao to Pol Pot, who murdered millions in their warped causes. It's true for 20th and 21st century institutional abuse, especially of children. Church institutional abuse too. Now focused, but tragically not limited to, the Roman Catholic Church. Into that world, you see, speaks not the voice of a denomination or an institution, but of Jesus. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. What does it look like?
to be safe and saved? As I look here, I discover it's the very opposite of all my instinctive fears. I fear a life of rules and regulations, but actually, Jesus speaks of relationship. I fear something narrow and restrictive. Jesus speaks of the saved person, the safe sheep, verse 9. You see, coming in and going out and finding pasture. I fear something dull or boring. Jesus says, verse 10, I've come that they may have life and have it to the full, abundant life. Now, we'd better be quick to admit, some of us Christians aren't very good at abundant life. We tend to specialize in a boring life. You know, we need to spend time with this Jesus have minds and attitudes and lives, faces even, transformed by this promise. It's a beautiful thing when you catch sight of it. You know, and you can get just a glimpse occasionally, can't you? This last week I came across a man called Floyd. I heard something of his story. He's a personality, he's eccentric, he's a Jesus person, he's a touch weird perhaps, but he's got this life. He's the kind of character, he's the kind of character who, he's in one of these sort of great shopping centres, and you'll see some old lady trudging rather dolefully around the shopping centre, and he'll go up to her with one of those big, warm, engaging smiles, and he says, you look as if you need a hug. And she'll sort of look up and he'll give her one. And they'll all leave with smiles on their faces. I mean, if I tried it, I'd be arrested for harassment. Floyd gets away with it. He was at one of those sort of food bars, you know, with kind of endless salad bars, all kinds of things stretched out across it. And then you can sort of get people to give you a bit of this, that and the other across the way. And the lady at the far end, I mean, you'll know the type, won't you? She'd been putting the carrot and raisin salad there for 26 years or something like that. Wore one of those hairnets, trifocals, and was morose. And Floyd comes up to her and says, you look as if you need a hug. She's horrified. And the smile gets her, and they stretch across the salad bar, and you know, the hug comes along, and he gets a bit on his plate, and he goes, and the next lady says, can't I have one? Takes him ages to go down the bar with everyone, and by the time he gets around, you can imagine, his plate is just piled high. And you know, the strangest thing I discovered about him is, he's a psychiatrist. Poor guy, he spends all day listening to people moaning about their wife, their husband, their boss, their minister. He says, if I can just give them a bit of encouragement. You sort of think he's credible, don't you, when he talks about someone who says, I've come that they may have life, and life to the full. Whoever enters by me will be saved. The gate who doesn't just welcome for an evening and a meeting, but forever. And can keep us for that forever. I am the gate, but if I want that life, if I want that being safe and saved, if I want that forever, I'll have to switch authorities. Stranger or the shepherd? Now go for the one who knows you. Shepherd or a thief? Go for the leader who gives, not who demands. But of course, everyone promises life, don't they? Yesterday I was at a 60th birthday of an old friend I've known ever since student days, and there were a group of us there, and we were chatting. One of the people there had visited the Asian subcontinent and spoke of some she'd met serving there, saying, you know, genuine people. And someone else immediately picked up on the comment and said, how do you know they were genuine? Now, what makes someone genuine? And he rounded on me. As far as I know, I was the only Christian there. He said, you're the vicar. You must have to deal with that question every day, don't you? And I was thinking, I'm so glad I'm speaking on this passage tomorrow. And I was desperately trying to remember what John 10 was teaching me. I said, look at the direction of travel. Watch the pattern of their life. Are they out to control or to protect? Are they out to get or to give? Everyone promises life. But not everyone promises to give their life. You see, most revolutionary talk, when you're planning a rebellion, you talk about how all the troops have got to give their life for the cause. Here, the cause gives his life for you. See, watch the last story, the good shepherd or the hired hand. Yeah, it begins in verse 11. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd who owns the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf will attack the flock and scatter it. The man runs away because he's the hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. See, who do you want running your life? I mean, the thing about the hired hand is not that they're out to take you for all they can get, like the thief. No, they're just doing a job. But that's the problem as well. Just that whatever salary they're on, there comes a moment when enough is enough. And they're not paid to go any further. And they're off. I lay down my life for the sheep. I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. It's a dangerous life to be a sheep, at least it was in those days. Wild animals, predators galore. If you're a sheep and you're choosing a shepherd, look, the big question is not how are you looked after on a sunny day with not a cloud in the sky and not a wolf on the horizon. It's what happens when the wolf comes, hungry for just a little cold lamb. Yeah, that's when it matters. Face to face with the wolf, sheep are powerless unless the shepherd intervenes. And you know, the wolves in life, don't they? They strike in all kinds of places. Just when we think we've got life under control, loss of health, loss of job, loss of family, loss of justice, loss of goodness. But the biggest wolf of all is death and judgment. I'm powerless in the face of them. You're powerless in the face of them. Who'll be for me on that day? I am the good shepherd. I lay down my life for the sheep. I'll face the wolf's attack so the sheep live. I'll face the judgment for sin so the sinner lives. You and I can't survive without a shepherd. And be sure we need one who's going to help us on that day. I lay down my life for the sheep. I don't know if you feel the same tensions I do listening to Jesus. The more it registers what he's saying, the more outrageous it sounds. And then, you see, I look a little more closely. And I see my fears dissolve. It felt limited. Whoever enters through me will be saved. It smacks of something exclusive, doesn't it? And then I look and I see inclusion. Look there at verse 9. Whoever enters through me. None of us are left out. It's open to all of us. It doesn't exclude any particular class. It doesn't matter what wealth you've got. It doesn't matter what merit you have. It doesn't matter what your ethnicity is. Well, look at verse 10. Verse 16, I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. He's speaking to the Jewish people, but his whoever doesn't stop with them. I must bring them also. The Arab, the Asian, the European, the American, the Antipodean. It feels controlling. The very idea of a shepherd keeping an eye on me, yet every time it works out in terms of care. Come in and go out and find pasture and have life. Young Japanese girl, just become a Christian. And a friend asks, don't you feel Christianity leaves you all fenced in? And she says, yes. Yeah, you're right. It says it does feel as if the fences are going up, but I find that inside the fence it's like a garden. And outside it's like a desert. And I find that when I want to walk from one side of the garden to the other, I find I never get to the other side. I lay down my life for the sheep. It seems to be all about power and authority, but I look and I see, actually it's about selflessness and sacrifice. The shepherd didn't just talk of laying down his life, he did it. For me. His story ends on a cross. Well, only it doesn't. There's still an empty tomb to come. But look at verse 17. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life. Now put yourself in the Father's shoes for a moment. How does a father ask his son to make that kind of sacrifice? He doesn't need to. The son's already got the same heart for the sheep. I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. See, I can't face lines like this with any integrity and then rob Jesus of his love and his concern by dismissing his death as unfortunate or a tragic accident or out of his depth with the power struggles that were going on. Now, verse 18, I have authority to lay it down. Jesus is the one with the power. It's how he chose to use it that's so staggering. I mean, time and time again, leaders sacrifice their people to save their power. It's happening around the world at the moment. Jesus uses his power to sacrifice himself to save his people. And he's still a live option as a leader. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again, verse 18. This command I received from my Father. Now, the resurrection's no surprise either. So you see, who are you following? Who are you following? We're all following someone, even those of you who insist, oh, I'm not having anyone that's going to control me, I'll just do what I want. You're just following yourself. Which is not a lot of help when the wolf comes. Because you're as incompetently powerless in the face of the wolf as I am. Who are you following? Some people think this talk of Jesus, these claims, they're just too good to be true. Some people think that and worse. You see, look at verse 19. At these words, the Jews were again divided. Many of them said he's demon-possessed and raving mad. Why listen to him? Well, they're not going to come back and hear anymore. But others have seen and heard too much to buy that solution. It may well be convenient, but it doesn't fit the evidence. So verse 21, but others said, these aren't the sayings of a man possessed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of a blind man? You know, if spiritual forces are at work, they're not the forces of evil. So who are you following? Have you any good reason why it shouldn't be this good shepherd?